This is the Biblical Unitarian Podcast.
Greetings, friends. You're listening to the Biblical Unitarian Podcast, the podcast that aims to start conversations about the oneness and unity of God and about the humanity of Jesus. This is episode 173, entitled Mark's High Human Christology, Chapter 15. My name is Dustin Smith, and as always, I will be your host. Thanks for tuning in to this episode. If you're a regular listener and you enjoy the content of the podcast, please do me a huge favor and help raise awareness for the podcast with your truth-seeking friends. Help others come to know about this weekly discussion on the Biblical Unitarian Podcast, which, as far as I'm aware, is the only weekly Unitarian podcast in the world. In this week's episode, we will wrap up our study of Mark's Christology by looking at the account of Jesus' rejection, suffering, and death by crucifixion. First, we will look at the phrase, King of the Jews, and ask why it is that Mark has concentrated these references to the chapter where Jesus is being crucified. Why only regard Jesus as the King of the Jews now, when Jesus is dying? Well, Mark has a reason for doing so, and it's pretty important. Next, we will look at Jesus' citation of Psalm 22, where he cries out to, quote, "My God, my God," end quote. In doing so, we will note the context of the quoted psalm and the way in which Mark has organized the depiction of Jesus' suffering and death in light of the psalm's influence. Lastly, we will look at the confession of the Gentile centurion, who calls Jesus a human being, as well as regarding him as the Son of God. Is this to be understood as a legitimate, sincere confession by the centurion? Or should we interpret his words in light of the mocking confessions made by nearly every other opponent of Jesus within this chapter? Let's find out on this week's episode of the Biblical Unitarian Podcast. Our first point today is the mocking of the King of the Jews. What I'll be doing is I'll be reading a handful of passages within Mark chapter 15 where Jesus is called the King of the Jews. So I'll begin in chapter 15, verse 1. Early in the morning, the chief priest with the elders and scribes and the whole council immediately held a consultation, and binding Jesus, they led him away and delivered him to Pilate. Pilate questioned him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And he answered him, "It is as you say." That's Mark 15, verses 1 through 2. Let's jump down to verse 8. The crowd went up and began asking him to do as he had been accustomed to do for them. Pilate answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the King of the Jews?" For he was aware that the chief priest had handed him over because of envy. Mark 15, verses 8 through 10. Jumping down to verse 12. Answering again, Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with him whom you call the King of the Jews?" They shouted back, "Crucify him." That's verses 12 through 13. Let's jump to verse 17. They dressed him up in purple, and after twisting a crown of thorns, they put it on him, and they began to acclaim him, "Hail, King of the Jews." That's Mark 15, verses 17 through 18. Let's jump down to verse 26. The inscription of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. That's verses 26 through 27. Let's look at verse 31. In the same way, The chief priests also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, "He saved others, he cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross, so that we may see and believe." Those who were crucified with him were also insulting him. That's Mark 15, verses 31 through 32. So as we've noted here, there seems to be a deliberate concentration of king references in regard to Jesus within this chapter, Mark chapter 15. And in fact, prior to Mark chapter 15, the only references to a king within the Gospel of Mark have been used of King Herod. No other chapter in the Gospel of Mark calls Jesus a king other than Mark chapter 15. So when we place the claim that Jesus is the King of the Jews within its historical context, we can take note of some pretty important points. We first need to note that only Rome had the authority to authorize someone to be king. Herod the Great and his sons were client kings set in authority over Galilee by Rome. The Herods were only allowed to act as kings because Rome allowed it and sanctioned it. For Jesus to claim to be king and to speak of a kingdom being ushered in with his ministry was a seditious affront to Roman rule. Also, only the Roman governor could authorize the death penalty of crucifixion, not the leaders of Jerusalem. So by sentencing Jesus to death by crucifixion, Rome, specifically here Pilate, demonstrated that it was still in charge and that no rival king would get in the way of Rome's rule and reign. Thirdly, when Pilate asked the Jews in 15 verses 12 through 13 what he should do with, quote, "him whom you call the King of the Jews," end quote, this is actually a test of Jewish loyalty towards Rome. What are the Jews to do with this political pretender Jesus, who acts as a rival king to Caesar? The Jews at this time do not back Jesus as their Messiah. And in fact, the disciples of Jesus, who should have courageously backed Jesus, are sadly nowhere to be found. For the Jews to back Jesus as their king, this would pit the Jews against Rome. The Jewish mob instead responds to Pilate that Jesus is to be crucified. Pilate is therefore able to assure Jewish submission to Rome with their response to his question regarding what should be done with this king of the Jews. So this leads us to our question about why Mark has decided to concentrate these king references to Jesus within this chapter, specifically where Jesus is being crucified. Well, the answer has to be that Mark's Christology in the entire narrative of the gospel has been about defining and redefining what it means to be the Son of God. Now, remember, Son of God is a title for the Jewish king. Prior to the writing of the Gospel of Mark, Jewish theology regarded the royal title, Son of God, to indicate the descendant of David to whom is promised a throne, a dynasty, and a kingdom forever. You can see this in 2 Samuel chapter 7. However, there was no indication anywhere in Jewish theology that the promised messianic Son of God would suffer and die. And this is something that Mark is seeking to correct. And he understands the ministry of Jesus as consciously redefining Son of God to not just be a royal vocation of one who is anointed to rule and reign in God's kingdom, but also someone who represents the people in suffering and dying. The climactic confession of Peter in Mark chapter 8 indicated clearly that Jesus was the Christ. So Jesus went on immediately to teach that he was destined to rejection, suffering, and death. Peter and the other disciples didn't know what to make of this redefinition of the Son of God, and Peter vocally resisted Jesus in this radical redefinition. The King of Israel was supposed to rule and reign from David's throne, not suffer at the hands of the Romans and the leaders in Jerusalem. Now, we've also seen evidence that those demons who confessed Jesus' identity earlier in the narrative of the Gospel of Mark were silenced from telling anyone who Jesus was. And the reason for this silencing is surely that a confession of Jesus as the Son of God without the understanding that the King of Israel also had to be rejected, had to suffer, and die, was an incomplete understanding of what Son of God truly meant. So it is not surprising that Mark, in the chapter where Jesus is actually facing rejection, suffering, and death on the cross, that we see this emphasis made over and over, that it is what the true King of the Jews looks like. The kingdom of God brings restoration and rule by first dealing with sin and death. And the way that God does this is through his anointed Messiah. Now, the irony of this passage is that Jesus is mocked as a false king by those who do not regard one sentenced to die as a seditious political revolutionary. And the irony is strengthened because Jesus' followers, as evidenced by Peter's response in Mark chapter 8, also didn't initially grasp how someone who suffers and dies could be the true King of the Jews. Readers of Mark's narrative, who have paid careful attention to the clues, know better, and they sense this narrative irony. So by concentrating references to Jesus, the King of the Jews, around the suffering and crucifixion of Jesus, Mark continues to emphasize that what it means to be the royal Son of God involves suffering and death. Let's move on to our second point, point number two, which is Psalm 22 and the suffering of Jesus. I'll be reading Mark 15, verse 34, which says, "At the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which is translated, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" That's Mark 15, verse 34. Now, in this passage, Jesus on the cross cites Psalm 22, verse 1. And Psalm 22 was originally written in Hebrew, but for those who are familiar with Hebrew and Aramaic, you can actually see that the way that Jesus cites this is actually that Jesus is citing it in Aramaic. And this means that Jesus impressed upon his memory the contents of Psalm 22, and Jesus quoted it with his own Aramaic translation. Mark sought to preserve the Aramaic sayings of Jesus with this important citation, and this indicates that it was deeply important to him and to early Christians. Now, the contents of Psalm 22 seem to fill the way in which Mark has organized and presented the depiction of Jesus' suffering and death within this chapter, within Mark chapter 15. Now, if we had a longer period of time, we would read the entirety of Psalm 22, and we would highlight the major distinctive points, but we don't have time to read all of Psalm 22. I'm just going to point out its pivotal points and the ways in which Mark draws on Psalm 22 in order to organize and portray the scene of the death of Jesus. Now, Psalm 22 is what scholars call a psalm of lament. And psalms of lament involve three parties. And the identity of these three parties is very important for Mark's Christology. In Psalms of Lament, we have the first party, which is the suffering psalmist, the writer of the psalm. The second party is the enemies who bring about that suffering. And the third party is God, who brings rescue and deliverance for the suffering psalmist. So we have one who suffers, we have the enemies, and we have God as the three parties within typical Hebrew Psalms of Lament. Now, by citing Psalm 22, Jesus, of course, is taking the place of the suffering psalmist. And in doing so, Mark is making sure we understand that Jesus is distinguished from God. The psalm opens by referring to God as, quote, "my God." And Jesus says this twice, "my God, my God." And he asks why it appears that God has forsaken the one who is suffering. And this again indicates that Jesus had a God, and Jesus referred to that God as my God. Not surprisingly, Jesus was a good monotheist. Now, within the psalm, originally, Psalm 22, mocking takes place. The suffering one in Psalm 22 is depicted as one who is surrounded by his enemies. We can also note that in Psalm 22, his enemies sneer at him and they wag their head at him. The suffering one in Psalm 22 is surrounded by evildoers. We can also note that Psalm 22 has the clothes and the garments of the suffering one divided. The suffering psalmist cries out to God, and God seems, initially, to have forsaken the one who is suffering. But towards the end of Psalm 22, we have a curious mention of nations and the prosperous of the earth, and these are ones who are described as submitting to God's rule, and they respond in reverence. They respond in worship. Now, at the end of Psalm 22, we have God answering the call of the suffering one by saving and rescuing him. So all of these key distinctives from Psalm 22 have actually made their way into Mark's reconstructed narrative of the suffering and crucifixion of Jesus. And what this tells us is that Psalm 22 and its contents are framing the way in which Jesus is the suffering one who awaits vindication from God. And thereby, Psalm 22 becomes an important clue in how we understand Mark's depiction of Jesus and God. So we've looked at the various distinctives within Psalm 22. Let's note how Mark plants them in key ways within Mark chapter 15. So first, just as there is mocking in Psalm 22, the Jews, the two criminals on the cross, and the Romans all mock Jesus. Just as the suffering psalmist is surrounded by his enemies, Mark depicts Jesus suffering and dying while surrounded by his enemies. The suffering one in Psalm 22 speaks of the shaking of heads by those who are his enemies, and those who pass by Jesus were wagging their heads at Jesus. Psalm 22 depicts the suffering one surrounded by evildoers, and Jesus is crucified with two political revolutionaries. I know the NASB translates it as robbers, but you can't be crucified for being a thief. The word for robbers in Greek, listis, could also mean a political revolutionary, a bandit, something along those lines. Now, the suffering one has his clothes divided, and of course, Mark depicts Jesus as having his garments divided. Psalm 22 opens with a cry to God, and of course, Jesus cries out to his God. Now, this point, I think, is often overlooked, but I think it's really vital for what we're going to look at later. We noted that the nations and the prosperous of the earth submit to God's rule by showing reverence and worship. And at the end of Mark 15, there's a Gentile centurion who comes to admit that Jesus truly is the Son of God. And lastly, the suffering one in Psalm 22 looks forward to God's salvation and rescue. And of course, Jesus is raised from the dead, leaving behind an empty tomb. So by weaving together the story of Jesus' rejection, suffering, and death, in light of the pivotal elements in Psalm 22, Mark is able to depict Jesus as taking the role of the lamenting, suffering one who regards the rescuing God as his God. In other words, Mark's use of Psalm 22 indicates that Jesus has a God above him, thereby distinguishing Jesus from God. Jesus and God are never confused within the Gospel of Mark. Let's move to our third and final point. Point number three, the Gentile centurion and the human Jesus. In Mark 15, verse 39, we read, "When the centurion, who was standing right in front of him, saw the way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly, this man was the Son of God.'" It's Mark 15, verse 39. Now, as Jesus dies, this Gentile centurion makes two important admissions in regard to Mark's Christology. First, the Gentile identifies Jesus as a man, as a human being. It says in Greek, "utos o anthropos," this man, this human being. Second, the centurion acknowledges Jesus as the Son of God. And each of these points has been argued by Mark himself within Mark's narrative. Jesus has consistently been depicted as a human being, as the Son of Man, as the lineal descendant of David, and as the Israelite king. All of these titles, Son of Man, Son of David, Israelite king, regard someone who is a member of the human race. Mark has also emphasized that Jesus is the Son of God. Mark opened the gospel with this declaration in chapter 1, verse 1. Jesus is called Son of God at his baptism. He is called Son of God by the demons. And even God himself calls Jesus Son of God at the transfiguration. And now at the end, we have the centurion making this confession. Furthermore, the centurion points out that the Son of God is appropriate as a title for one who has suffered and died, which is exactly what Mark wants his readers to understand about the title that has been redefined, as we observed in our initial point, point number one. However, there are a number of scholars who have interpreted the confession made by the Gentile centurion as a snarky, sarcastic, and ironic confession, as if the centurion was saying people were dumb enough to think that this guy, who was just crushed by the mighty Romans, as the Son of God. Ha ha ha. Now, on this interpretation, the Gentile would be continuing the mocking that has taken place throughout the chapter. We saw that there was mocking, made by the Jews. There is mocking by the Romans, and even the two crucified criminals, one on Jesus' right and one on Jesus' left, they also mocked Jesus. So if this reading is correct, that the Gentile centurion is also mocking Jesus, then it would add some further irony to the chapter, where a Gentile unwittingly admits something that Mark wants his readers to know, to accept, and to believe. In other words, the mocking centurion speaks truly without even knowing it. So, which reading is correct? Is Mark depicting this Gentile centurion making a legitimate, sincere confession, knowingly acknowledging that Jesus, the man, is the Son of God? Or is Mark portraying the centurion as sarcastically saying that Jesus, really, this guy, is the Son of God? Now, a good case could actually be made for both options, although both certainly cannot be true at the same time. Also, whichever option is correct still works for depicting Mark's Christology, where Jesus is the human Son of God who suffers and dies. Now, if you want to know what I think, personally, I think that Mark is having his readers understand that the Gentile centurion is making an authentic, genuine confession rather than a sarcastic confession. And here are the reasons that currently persuade me. There really isn't anything in the narrative that leads me to think that what he says is less than authentic. You kind of have to read into what he's saying as a sarcastic confession, which is possible, but I think it's less than likely. Now, an authentic confession by this Gentile would fit well into Mark's theme, where the unlikely persons understand who Jesus is, while those whom you might expect to know who Jesus is, like the Jews and the closest disciples of Jesus, do not, in fact, know. In Mark's gospel, the unlikely demons and unclean spirits know who Jesus is. We've also noted that the Syrophoenician woman seems to regard Jesus favorably. So a non-Jewish centurion fits this theme of the unlikely persons making a positive confession of Jesus' identity. Now, I noted the careful way in which Mark depicts this chapter in light of Psalm 22, and I also noted that Psalm 22 portrays Gentiles as submitting to God's reign with reverence. Having a Gentile centurion confess Jesus as the Son of God, the King of the Jews, would fit Mark's agenda of setting the narrative of this chapter in light of Psalm 22. And no other Gentile in Mark chapter 15 fulfills this particular point from Psalm 22. Also, the centurion who stood facing Jesus is accompanied by several women who are also looking from a distance, according to the very next verse. And these women are sympathetic to Jesus, suggesting that the centurion is also sympathetically making a genuine confession. Now, a true confession by the Gentile centurion would create a narrative inclusio, where the Gospel of Mark opens with a confession that Jesus is the Son of God, chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 11, and the Gospel concluded with the confession that Jesus is the Son of God by this Gentile centurion. So the argument of a creative narrative structure where the positive, affirming, authoritative confession of Jesus as the Son of God bookends the contents of the Gospel of Mark. And I think a organized narrative structure can serve as evidence. Either way, the Gentile centurion admits that Jesus, the Son of God, is a man. Jesus is a human being. So in conclusion, we have observed that the ending of Mark's gospel is filled with references that flesh out the person and identity of Jesus Christ, the narrative's main character. In doing so, Mark is able to help readers come to better understand his Christological perspective. We first noted that references to Jesus being the King of the Jews were all concentrated around the retelling of his crucifixion. By stressing that the Messiah is proving his identity as the Jewish king by being rejected, by suffering, and by dying, Mark is able to redefine the royal Son of God into a person whose destiny involves dying for other people. Second, we observe that the narrative portrayal of Jesus' death was deliberately influenced by the 22nd Psalm, which is a psalm of lament involving a suffering figure, his enemies, and a rescuing God. By framing the details of Jesus' death in light of the distinctive elements of Psalm 22, Mark further demonstrates his commitment to portraying Jesus as the suffering righteous one who is distinguished from the one whom he calls my God. Lastly, we carefully noted how the death of Jesus is accompanied by a Christological confession by the unlikely figure of a Gentile centurion. His confession, which probably is genuine and sincere, regards Jesus as a human being as well as emphasizing the repeated theme of the Son of God, whose vocation involves suffering and dying. Now, throughout our lengthy study of the Christology in the Gospel of Mark, we have noted that Jesus is hardly a mere man. He is the Messiah who is highly empowered and greatly authorized. He is ranked above the angels, and he is even bearing God-given prerogatives, like the ability to forgive sins. So I think this is a high view of Jesus, not a low view of Jesus, not a mere man view of Jesus. However, Mark consistently portrays Jesus as a human being, a member of the human race. Furthermore, the Markan Jesus has a God, and that God is the Father alone. By portraying Jesus as a highly empowered human being who is distinct from God, Mark's portrayal seems to more appropriately be labeled as a high human Christology rather than a high divine Christology or a low mere man Christology. Thanks so much for listening to this week's episode. Join us next week as we explore a new topic. We will look at the phrase Maranatha, which is an Aramaic phrase calling Jesus Lord. What can a detailed study of Aramaic tell us about what early Aramaic-speaking Christians meant by calling Jesus Lord? Please look forward to this episode. Now, if you enjoy the podcast, please consider supporting us as we promote the sound truths of the oneness and unity of God and the humanity of Jesus. If you want to offer a donation, you may check out the episode's description for a PayPal link. The Biblical Unitarian Podcast is produced and edited by Dustin Williams, and I am Dustin Smith, the podcast host. Until next time, you folks, please take care.